1,200 and 80 days. In other words, 1,260 days. The same amount of time as described previously on the transparency we put up. A period of 1,260 days. Now, there is a difference. This period of 1,260 days, whilst being the same amount of time, is not the same time period. It overlaps in measure the other particular period. But let's have a look first of all at the terms which we've got here. I will give to my two witnesses, I'll give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days. Now who are these two witnesses? Let's go back to our notes then. Because they are clothed in sackcloth, they are seen to be in affliction. And under these conditions, they would prophesy or preach. Prophesy means to speak forth. The two witnesses are described as standing before in the sense of being in opposition to. It's a bit like saying that Nimrod was a great hunter before Yahweh. He was a great hunter in defiance of Yahweh. Here then there are two witnesses who are standing before or in opposition to the God of the earth in verse 4. Now let's take these terms carefully, because you see when you read the God of the earth quickly you think, oh yes, the God who created the earth. Oh no, no, no. The earth in the apocalypse symbolizes a certain thing. Therefore the God of the earth is that God which the class of people styled the earth have set up as their God. So the God of the earth is different from the God of heaven referred to later in the chapter. So then, here are two witnesses who for a period of 1260 days, which we will see to be years, stand up in defiance of the God set up by the class of people called the earth. I told you it was going to be easy, it's just a matter of following it carefully. So it takes a while to sort of unlearn the fact that the term God of the earth doesn't mean, as we've always thought, the God who created it. In this particular case, it is that God set up by the earth class. So our notes tell us, the two witnesses are described as standing before or in opposition to the God of the earth, not to be confused with the God of heaven. Verse 13. The two witnesses include the true and faithful members of the one body who would not take the sword, and their revolutionary allies known as the Protestants, who had no scruples. They are collectively the woman and the earth. Now those two terms, the woman and the earth, are again presupposing a knowledge of chapter 12, which we haven't studied. So the two witnesses then are the woman and the earth. They are a religious group because the woman is associated with the idea of the bride of Christ, but not always the true bride, because that woman who started off as a chaste virgin to Christ eventually became the great whore of Revelation chapter 17. But woman always stands in the sense of a religious power. The earth, on the other hand, was a political power. So what we're going to have here is two people who are going to witness not so much for the truth as against error. Can we get that? They are standing before the God of the earth. So here are two groups who are going to stand up and oppose the God of the earth. They're going to stand up and oppose this papal God. It doesn't necessarily mean, though, that they believe the truth in so doing. After all, one of these are known as the Protestants. And the Protestants don't believe the truth. So in this woman class, some of the woman class, styled in the apocalypse, the women of the woman seed, do believe the truth. But the majority of that woman class were simply people who didn't believe the truth. All they knew was they hated Rome. And of course there was the earth, who were people that hated Rome just because they hated Rome. So what happened was then God allowed these two groups to stand up and oppose Rome. Now, to try and bring this all into focus, not P-H-O-C-A-S, but the other one, to try and bring it then into perspective, what we've got is this. God's saying, right, now over in Europe we're going to have the true believers as a persecuted minority. They will be persecuted by the false church, styled the court without. But I won't allow that false church to persecute them unto the death, because I will allow another two groups to come up who will oppose those false worshippers, styled here the God of the earth now in this case, or their prime patriarch, who would be the Pope. So you see, you've got a balanced sort of condition. You've got a certain amount of persecution being brought upon the true believers by the apostate worshippers, but the apostate Roman system itself being opposed by the two witnesses, who are the Protestants, the religious Protestants, and the earth, who were, if you like, political Protestants, who protested against Rome. So they sort of held them at bay. And these political Protestants and religious Protestants, they prophesied, they spoke forth against Rome for 1260 years. Now, the 1260 year period during which they prophesied was a period actually starting from the time when Rome, per medium of Constantine, commenced its power. And so overlapping then this other period of AD 610 to 1870, we have the 1260 year period of witnessing from 312 to 1572. Perhaps we can have our interval. Not a change over. Once you get through these first three verses, it becomes quite easy after that, so no worries once we've just got these two time periods. Right. All back on the air again. So then, having seen that in verse 2 there was a period of 1260 years, which was the period of the treading down of the true believers from the time of Phocas to the fall of the temporal power of the papacy, we've now got a period of witnessing against the papacy by these two classes, who, whilst the majority of them didn't believe the truth, they did oppose Rome. And so here in verse 3, we have that period going from 312 to 1572, which was the period of their witnessing. Now, to describe what this represents, we can once again go back to our notes. I think about the fifth line from the bottom of that paragraph we were just reading. The woman class include both the true and faithful members of the one body, as well as their revolutionary allies known as Protestants, and are described in Revelation chapter 12 as the woman and the remnant of her seed. The other witnessing class, styled the earth, consists of the political opponents of the Roman Catholic power. So your two witnesses then are the woman and the earth. In the woman class there was a very small remnant who were the true believers, but the bulk of the woman class were simply the Protestants. The rest, the earth, they were the political opponents of Rome. So this 1260 day period, whilst being the same length of time as that in verse 2, refers to a different period. It speaks of a warfare that commenced at the time of the establishment of the state church in 312 to the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day, actually, in AD 1572. I'm not going to read the note on page 120. It's a very, very detailed analytical outline of a whole series of wars, which I put in there for those who would like to read it. The fact, though, is that the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day was the climax of this period of witnessing, and in fact brought to an end the period of witnessing. We're going to come to more of that when we come to verse 7. So that's about all I'm going to say on that at the moment. So let me then try and briefly summarise the essential features of what we've seen, so that if you've found any of the little details a bit hard to consume, these are the things we should remember. John is told to rise up and measure out a symbolic period of affliction for the true believers, represented here by the temple of God, the altar, and then worship therein. This period of affliction was going to be a period of affliction in which those in the outer court, those who called themselves Christians but weren't really Christians, were going to tread them down. And that was a period of 1260 years from the decree of Phocas, when the Catholic power was given temporal power, through to the time when the temporal power was taken away from the Pope in 1870. Now, in order then that that power might not persecute the true believers to an unlimited extent, God allowed two groups to rise up. One was the group known as the Protestants, and the other were the political opponents of Rome. And they stood up in defiance of this Roman God, this one who set himself up in the temple of God claiming that he was God, this papal system. And so for 1260 years, dating from the time when that church system started with Constantine, through to the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day, these witnesses witnessed against Rome. What of course happened in 1572, as we shall see later on, was a terrible massacre, and the witnessing came to an end for the time being. The rest of the chapter will show us later how there was a renewal of the witnessing in later times. So the witnesses then were not so much witnessing for the truth as they were witnessing against error. If we can get that clearly in our minds and very clearly in our margins, when you come back to Revelation chapter 11 at some later date, it'll become fairly apparent. I would say that, you know, of all the different views on Revelation that tend to flit around from time to time, chapter 11 comes in for the most diverse number of different interpretations, because people automatically assume that the witnesses must be witnessing for the truth. They automatically assume that. So they've then got to make the whole of their exposition fit around the fact that the two witnesses believe the truth. But it doesn't say that. It simply says they were standing up before the God of the earth. So they were witnessing against error, not necessarily witnessing for truth. Now, I think if we've got that clear, then really the rest of it all falls into place. Verse 4. These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the God of the earth. Our notes tell us that the two witnesses prophesying for 1260 days are declared to be the two olive trees and the two lampstands which have stood before the God of the earth. The two olive trees here are not united by pipes into one lampstand as in Zechariah 4. There are two lampstands with a tree to each. One olive tree and lampstand symbolising the one body of the saints, and the other is symbolical of the earth, the anti-Catholic and anti-papal champion of civil and religious liberty and the rights of man, standing defiantly before the God of the earth. I should at this stage launch into an exposition of Zechariah chapter 4. Not going to do that, because it's a study we did not all that long ago, and Brother Thomas does deal with it at length in Eureka, in the appropriate section, so I'm not going to digress onto that at the moment, although we could find good justification for doing so. But the symbol is based on Zechariah chapter 4, and to some extent on Romans as well. The God of the earth here is not to be mistaken for the eternal creator. Now, we've said all this before, but we'll keep reading. His title in this chapter is the God of heaven, to whom glory is ascribed as the concluding act of the second woe. It is true that the witnesses, in a certain sense, stand before the Creator, but in the sense of giving testimony against him, they do not. And that before is to be understood in the sense of against is evident from the effect of their testimony, which torments and stirs up the powers to destroy them. So we're quite right in assuming that the word to stand before God means in the sense to be standing against this God of the earth because the subsequent events show that it stirred up this god of the earth to war against them. These two classes of anti-papists confront the representatives of the papal deity in all the nations of the earth. The god of the earth is therefore synonymous with the Antichrist, in contrast to the god of heaven. Right, verse 5. If any man will hurt them, fire proceedeth out of their mouth and devoureth their enemies, and if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. The God of heaven did not require the members of the one body to stand and be murdered by their enemies without some sort of help. The earth class, not believing in non-resistance and passive obedience to ecclesiastical tyranny, stood their ground and devoured their enemies. This was their mode of prophesying against the Antichrist, which in all the days of the prophecy was very effective in the preservation of civil and religious liberty and the rights of man, and in perpetuating them to succeeding generations. So God allowed them, this political class, to stand up and oppose the papacy for the benefit of the true believers, who, whilst they would be trodden down, would not be entirely wiped out. The earth class had no compunctions at all about killing, and so God allowed them to do just that for the benefit of the saints. The earth, or political opponents of the papacy, went to the aid of the true brethren and stood ready to defend them with the sword. History records many examples of groups who, though not agreeing with the teaching of the woman or the remnant of her seed, were nevertheless ready to defend her. The fire which proceeded out of their mouth represents the wars of the witnesses against their Catholic persecutors. So down through this period, there were quite a number of wars. And if you want to know all about those wars, as I said, they're outlined there on page 120, and they're entitled The Wars of Religion, particularly those culminating wars around that period of 1562 right through to 1598. And there were a lot of wars around that time, which was the period of the culminating of this vision, 1572 being the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day, which was so important that the Pope struck a medal for it being so successful. He wiped out so many Huguenots that day that he considered it was worth striking a medal for it. Verse 6. These have power to shut heaven that it rain not in the days of their prophecy, and have power over waters to turn them to blood and to smite the earth with all plagues as often as they will. Well, to shut up heaven that rain might not descend upon those who live under it is figurative of divine wrath upon the sufferers. In this case, it is the political heavens that are referred to, and therefore represents peace being taken from the earth. The waters refer to peoples, and therefore speaks of the effect on those involved in the warfare. So, these first six verses, which are a section in the chapter, simply tell us that the true believers were to be persecuted, they were to be persecuted by the false believers, God was going to allow two groups to stand up, the Protestants on the one hand, and the political opponents of Rome on the other hand, and they would make war down through the ages against the papacy, so much so that there would be peace taken away from that part of the earth, and there would be continual wars in the cause of religion. That's why people will tell you with some sort of apparent, they feel it's their justification for not being religious, they say that there have been more wars fought in the name of religion than any other cause, and they're quite correct. And they say, well, if that's the case, who wants to be religious? Well, of course, that's not correct. But it is true that during that period of time, virtually all wars were in some way or other related to religion. The Protestants versus the Catholics, with the earth class having their little bit to do with it as well. Now, verse 7 then brings us back to this theme of the culmination of the persecution. When they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them, and kill them. This is the first reference to the beast, but again it's another symbol of that same Roman power, and it's now going to start linking it up with the beasts, of course, of Daniel chapter 7, because Revelation is the counterpart of Daniel. And this great fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7, this great dreadful and terrible beast, unnamed beast, it was so terrible there was no name for it, this Roman beast is now going to appear in Revelation, and John is going to break it down into its component elements. It's going to be, first of all, a great red dragon. Then it's going to be a ten-horned beast. Then it's going to be a two-horned beast. Then it's going to be a beast with a woman riding on it. The various phases of the Roman Empire. So we now see the appearance of this beast, because this is the way John is now going to proceed in chapter 12 onwards to describe this great Roman power. But the main point we're going to take out of this verse at the moment is the fact that this period of testimony, of testifying, this period of witnessing, came to an end. It came to an end in 1572. Our note then on page 122 summarizes this. The trampling of the holy city was one thing, and its prophesying in sackcloth was another. These two series of events were not to be parallel in the whole of their courses. In other words, what we're saying is that whilst there was 1260 years in verse 2 and 1260 years in verse 3, they were not exactly the same period. That's all it's saying, just repeating what we've said before. So to prevent confusion, the two periods of equal duration were stated in different terms. First one was called 42 months, and the second one 1260 days. The witnesses through the ages have included Donatists, Waldenses, Novatians, Huguenots, etc. You know, the question is often raised, you know, did the Huguenots really believe the truth? Did the Waldenses believe the truth? Did the Donatists believe the truth? Well, the Seventh-day Adventists will tell you that the Donatists believe exactly the same as the Seventh-day Adventists do. And we say, well, they held the truth as Christadelphians do. Well, they all had smatterings of the truth. It's very difficult to say how much they had. 17th century Baptists had a lot of it. But the fact was, these were people who opposed Rome. That was the main thing. Many of them, no doubt, also held the truth. Or shall we say, some of them, no doubt, held the truth. The opposition of the witnesses, by word and sword, gave protection to the ecclesia. But as the 1260 year period neared its end in 1572, the hitherto forthright witnessing of the saints became lax. This being the case, the deity removed the protection. Now, this is really a very sobering thought. Let's read it again. As the 1260 year period neared its end, not because it was coming to an end, not because the ecclesia said, oh well, the 1260 years is nearly up, we're going to be persecuted now, so we might as well give up and stop witnessing. Oh no, that wasn't the reason. But looking back on it, as this period comes to an end, it was significant that the forthright witnessing of the saints became lax. Because the saints ceased to be a witnessing community, God removed the protection. And I think it's very interesting for us to try and look at our own situation, even look back over the last 20 years or so and say, you know, I wonder if changes in this state are in any way related to changes in our approach to witnessing. But please, I only ask that as a question. I have no conclusive thoughts. I'm not trying to suggest something to you in that. I just make it as a question. There have been rather remarkable changes in this particular state. Probably greater changes here than in just about any part of the Western world in the same period of time. From ultra-conservatism, from a society in which the church was protected, in which, you know, there was support given to religion, to a swing right the other way. Does this have any connection with a change in witnessing on our part? I ask it as a question. I've asked myself the question. I don't know that I've got an answer to it. But these are the sort of things we've got to ask, because this is what happened in 1572. The saints stopped witnessing. God said, you've stopped witnessing. I will stop protecting you. And so, this being the case, the deity removed the protection. The papacy gained the ascendancy, which was signalized by a terrible period of persecution that culminated in the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day. This effort on the part of the papacy continued until 1598, when the Toleration Edict of Nantes was issued by Henry IV. However, this was revoked by Louis XIV in 1685, and persecution continued apace. So what we're saying is that in 1572, there was persecution commenced. That persecution went on until 1598. But in 1598, there was an edict brought out, known as the Edict of Nantes, or the Edict of Toleration. So there was an edict brought out that says, no, let's tolerate these people. But then again in 1685, Louis XIV revoked that edict of toleration, and the persecution started up again. And we mention that time period there because shortly when we come down to one of these other verses here, we're going to find that that 3.5 days is mentioned, and it's connected with this particular period from 1685. So there was persecution then from 1572 to 1598. The toleration edict was made by Henry IV, and then there was what is sometimes called the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, which, you know, when a person reads that, they say, well, so what does that mean? Well, it simply means that an edict which permitted the saints to be tolerated was then revoked. It was brought out, taken away, was removed. So verse 7 then says that when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them, and shall kill them. Now, I think we ought to consider what the book of Revelation is all about. Remember something about 12 months ago, we put out a bit of a questionnaire which lost us a few class members but gave a bit of revision for others. And one of the first questions was, what is the book of Revelation all about? And the answer was, it's all about witnessing, because that was one of the important themes of chapter 1. It's all about witnessing. The Lord represents himself as the true and faithful witness. The word witness is the word martyrs, the word martyr, the word maturia. It's one who's prepared to give himself his life for the cause. And so here in Revelation chapter 11, we've got a witnessing community. We've got some who are standing up against the papacy, prepared to fight them, prepared to kill them. We've got another group who are prepared to stand up and witness for the truth. It's therefore very important, brethren and sisters, that we recognise that we must today be a witnessing community. To witness for the truth doesn't mean to say that we've got to resort to describing in detail all of the errors, all of the horrors, all of the immorality, all of the crime of the world. We don't have to resort to those such sorts of things to witness for the truth. Witnessing for the truth consists of lifting up people to recognise what the truth is all about. That witnessing in itself is a condemnation of the errors of the world. And so witnessing for the truth has to be seen in the things we say and in the things that we do. We therefore endeavour to lift people up out of the gutters to understand what the truth is all about. We don't, of course, have to drop our standards. We don't have to get down into the gutters to describe to the people how bad the world is, to try and lift them out of it. The Lord never did that, and we don't want to do it in our witnessing either. And so when we come on to verse 8, we find that their corpses were described as lying upon the breadth of the great city, spiritually styled Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. Now, this great city, which is described here as Sodom and Egypt, the great city of the apocalypse, is Babylon the Great. And the street, which is better translated as the Plataea or the Broadway, is France, the first and the chief Catholic country. This great city is evidently both a city and a country, and answers to the city of Rome, which was coextensive with the empire. Christ was crucified by Rome outside the walls of Jerusalem. He was therefore crucified in a province of the Roman Empire. For the Jews then inhabiting Palestine earnestly testified that they had no other king but Caesar. Hence the great city is the Empire of Rome, whose frontiers were declared by the Emperor Caracalla to be the limits of the city. In this great city, 3,000 miles in one direction and 2,000 in another, both the personal and the mystical Christ were put to death. By mystical we mean the body of Christ, the Ecclesia. So just as the Lord himself was crucified in the city of Jerusalem, which was the city of Rome, because Rome was coextensive with its empire, so also the body of Christ in a later generation was to suffer, as verse 8 describes it. With regard to the bodies of the witnesses remaining unburied, Brother Thomas states, "Now when people are buried, it is usual for the living to put them out of sight, or bury them as soon as possible. But in the case of these corpses, they would not suffer them to be entombed. Who would not suffer it? Their enemies, or some others friendly towards them? Certainly not their enemies, for these did their best to destroy them, and to blot out the remembrance of them forever. It was the protection afforded them in the Protestant states that prevented their burial and decomposition. The refugee witnesses that fled by hundreds of thousands from the presence of the deity of the earth and his regal adherents settled in Holland, Britain, Protestant Germany and America, where, under the protection of the laws, they existed as corporate societies but bearing no testimony as of old. Some of these governments remonstrated on their behalf, which was not without influence in staying the destroyer's hand. Hence an unburied remnant of them was permitted to remain in the breadth of the great city, a prostrate remnant no longer able to testify, but awaiting in silence their resurrection to life and power." This, of course, is spiritual death that's being spoken about here. The death of them as a community. It's not speaking necessarily about the death of individuals or of literal bodies lying around. So verse 9 goes on to say, reading Brother Thomas's translation, "And they shall see their corpses among the people and tribes and tongues and nations 3 days and a half, and they shall not suffer their corpses to be put into tombs." Well, that brings us then to our third period, this 3.5 days. This one you might consider a little bit of a tricky one, because it's not the conventional sort of day-year period. The 3.5 days here, relating to the period of the death of the ecclesia, shall we say, which is often described as the moon, turns out to be 3.5 days or lunar days. So I say this is a rather unusual one, but it turns out to be correct. Up here we had 42 months. Here we can take 3.5 day months. You see, sometimes we take day years, sometimes we take day months. Especially when you know the end result, you can look back and find out which one it is. Bible chronology is an amazing thing. We only scratch the surface of it. And no doubt in time to come, when we are granted the opportunity in immortality to look back on the scriptures, we will see a whole series of amazing events, all fitting together perfectly on the basis of days, years, months, weeks and so forth. But this one here fits so perfectly, as Brother Thomas points out, with the 3.5 days being 3.5 days of months, or months of days, whichever way it is grammatically. I haven't worked out which is correct, but it's 3.5 times 30 anyway, which equals 105 years. Now, this period is the period that I mentioned earlier, which started in 1685. Remember, there was the persecution of Bartholomew's Day in 1572. This persecution went on till 1598. In 1598, there was a toleration edict came out. And then in 1685, persecution started up again. And so for 3.5 day months, this persecution went on again. It went on from 1685 to 1790. And that brings us to the French Revolution. And we won't get into the French Revolution tonight, but that's where we're going to start up next time. So this period then, this 3.5 years, was the period of the Lord's ministry. It's referred to as a half a week in Daniel chapter 9. In this case, however, it refers to the time elapsing between the political death of the witnesses in 1685 and their political resurrection in the French Revolution in 1790. This is the death of the witnesses. It is a period of 105 years. It is significant to note that 105 is equal to 3.5 times 30. Therefore, Brother Thomas suggests that the days referred to are in fact lunar days, a period of 30 normal days answering to the phases of the moon. The Pope determined to commemorate the great slaughter of St. Bartholomew's Day and ordered a medal to be struck in commemoration of it. This illustrates the meaning of the statement that they would not suffer the dead bodies of the witnesses to be put in graves. To put a thing in the grave symbolically is to bury it out of sight, to forget it. Instead of being thus buried away, the slain witnesses were kept in public view in the way referred to. So he struck a medal so people wouldn't forget it. It was particularly in France that their dead bodies thus lay exposed in the symbolical sense, for there it was a day to be observed as every year came round, a day in which it was considered the Church in 1685 had finally triumphed over its enemies who had plagued it for years. And so finally, verse 10 brings us to the end of a section where we can conveniently leave it for this evening. And they who dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them and be exultant, and they shall send gifts to one another, because these two prophets tormented them who dwell upon the earth. So the earth referred to here is the Roman earth, that is, those within the orbit of Catholic control. Their rejoicing was perpetuated, as described previously, by the striking of a medal in commemoration of the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day. Well, it's a convenient point to leave it, but it is, of course, by no means the end of the story. Our theme then this evening has been to show to us that in Western Europe there was a group of people holding the truth. God said that you are going to be persecuted. You are the true nave. You are the true holy place. You are going to be persecuted by the outer court group, by the Gentiles without. You're going to be persecuted by the untrue, the false believers. But in order that they don't persecute you to the death, I'm going to raise up two witnesses who will testify against Rome. They will be the Protestants, a religious group, and they will be the earth, who are political opponents of Rome. And so for 1260 years, you will be downtrodden. That is from 610 to 1870. But for 1260 years, the witnesses will witness against Rome. That is 312 to 1572. When 1572 comes, there will be an end of witnessing. There will be a beginning of persecution. And so from 1572 through to 1685, there would be a period of, there was an early period of persecution. Then there was a removal of the persecution. But in 1685, there will be another big renewal of persecution again, which will go through until the great earthquake of verse 13, which we'll look at, God willing, next time, which was the French Revolution. So the exhortation is there to the extent that we are prepared to examine our situation today, compare it and contrast it with their day. We've got better opportunities than ever before to witness to the truth. We've got all the facilities we need at our disposal. We've got a community which is not only tolerant, it's quite apathetic about the whole situation. Therefore, brethren and sisters, let's make sure that we do witness to the truth of the Word of God. The Word of God can stand on its own merits. We hold that aloft, and we desire to raise people up to the limits which they can in the truth. Over the years, people have said, you know, public lectures are don't get enough strangers along. Let's try other sorts of gimmicks. Let's put on films. Let's put on song nights and all sorts of things like that. This does not necessarily witness to the truth. The fact of the matter is that the greatest witnessing to the truth is seen in the lives of each one of us individually. And we know, when we look at the brethren and sisters who've come into the truth over the years, that the great majority have not come in by necessarily all of the big, showy, ostentatious proclamation of the truth, and I'm not, of course, condemning big efforts in that sense, but they've come in because they have seen someone who was a Christadelphian, and that Christadelphian witnessed to the truth by the things they did, and of course by the things they didn't do. Someone realised that they were a different sort of person, they asked why, and maybe came into the truth. So the challenge is that in the midst of an apathetic world, let us not drop our standards at all. Let's hold the truth aloft both in word and in practice, and let's remain a strong, powerful witnessing community under the coming of Christ. Hymn 29.